Jojo Rabbit is already an Oscar favorite. The dark comedy from director Taika Waititi won the Audience Award at the Toronto International Film Festival. That's preceded a Best Picture nomination in 10 out of the last 11 years.
Based on a 2004 novel by Christine Lunens, the film follows Jojo, a German boy who remains loyal to Adolf Hitler as World War II winds down. In fact, he envisions the leader as his imaginary friend. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about the offbeat war comedy drama Jojo Rabbit on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen in the studio is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hey, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
And in our fourth chair is Bilal Qureshi. Bilal reports and produces cultural coverage for NPR. Hey, Bilal.
Hi, Linda.
It's always a pleasure to have you here. We don't have you here nearly enough.
So nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's wonderful. You and Glenn both saw this film at in Toronto. I didn't. Stephen and I saw it more recently. Just to orient people a little bit more in this film's very unusual world, Jojo is played by young Roman Griffin Davis.
Ooh.
Indeed. His charming and encouraging mother is played by Scarlett Johansson, and he's being mentored as part of Hitler Youth, which is his activity for fun, by an officer who's played by Sam Rockwell. And in one of those credits you're never sure that you're actually going to see in the world, it is also starring Taika Waititi as Adolf Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
Waititi also wrote and directed the film. It's a thinker for me. This one's a head-scratcher for me. It's a thinker. Glenn, what'd you think?
It depends on which of the two films you're asking me about. Because you called it a comedy-drama. It is a comedy, and then it's a drama.
Yeah.
In fact, it is such a profoundly goofy, broad, I would say cheesy, but kind of winningly cheesy film up until the precise moment it is not anymore.
Yeah.
And that big hiccup there is not going to work for a lot of people. It worked for me because there had been built up such momentum to kind of get me over that hump. I also thought, we can't get into this, but I think that moment is visually set up very strikingly and simply and well. But this film is not, I've heard it called a biting satire. There's no biting satire here.
No, I don't think it has it doesn't have the teeth for a satire.
The ostensible target is so broad. Explicit target here is, you know, Nazism and thought thinking behind it, if there is any. And it's just such a broad target. That's why the film's other big emotional moment, there's two. There's that first turn. And then toward the end, there's a big, it's meant to be cathartic. It's a moment that's kind of like almost a superhero catchphrase moment that's supposed to get the audience cheering. And in its defense, even in an audience of bleary, grumbly, hungover film critics, you know, at 8 o'clock in the morning, it still got the audience cheering.
Yeah.
That to me felt really flat because, again, that is the opposite of what I think the first part of the film is. It's the opposite of risky. It is the safest thing in the world, and it didn't work for me. That said, I still recommend this film. I did have a good time.
Yeah. And we should add, there is also a plot in which Jojo meets a Jewish girl who is played by Thomasin McKenzie, who she was in Leave No Trace, the Deborah Granik film about a father and daughter kind of living off the grid in the woods. She was wonderful in that film in a totally different performance. I'm a huge fan of her. I was delighted to see her in this. Blah, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm definitely in the camp that did not care that much for this film.
Yeah.
And I think there was definitely that division at Toronto between people who saw it. What struck me going into it was that it's very arresting visually because there's the marketing for it is super pop arty. There's a lot of red. It was described, and I think it's actually accurate, as kind of a Moonrise Kingdom for the Nazis.
That's what I thought of.
It has a lot of the same kind of like Wes Anderson-y set design. There's a lot of German kind of feathery hats and cool coats and popping sets. And I think that stuff is really fun. But I think, to your point, Glenn, that turn where the movie becomes this kind of moral fable, I think, didn't really work because to me it felt like either you have the biting teeth to make a movie that really goes for Hitler in the way that it should, or you do what the film does, which is try to reach in a very broad way. And also, I just want to mention, I lived in Germany in 2012, and this bestseller came out called Look Who's Back, which is this movie about a Hitler that returns to, like, modern Germany and walks around, and it was a bestseller. And it's not that there can't be movies that I think are really funny and really biting about this thing. I think it's just that this film, for me, was just tonally a bit all over the place, and I didn't feel like it knew what it wanted to be. That was how I felt, and it just the last hour of it just didn't work for me.
Yeah, and I felt like it's hard not to be charmed by Taika Waititi being funny and silly. He's very charming and I think a very charismatic on-screen presence in addition to being the director and writer. But also there are moments where Glenn has often made the point that a pop culture reference is not a joke.
Okay.
I would also say the unexpected insertion of slang, of anachronistic slang, is not a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And there are moments when they have him say, like, did I make it weird? Like, Hitler saying that is the joke. And it's not up there with, you know, we've sort of ranked this kind of thing on a level of zero to You to Ant in the movie Ants. It's not up there with You to Ant. That's not really a joke. And after a few times, it began to feel a little, you know, a little not sharpest. Stephen, what are you thinking?
I'm agreeing with bits and pieces of everything all three of y'all are throwing out. I'm very mixed on this movie. I love a big thematic swing. Linda, you and I have talked about this.
Yeah.
If you're gonna lose, you might as well lose big. You know,
I'm the one who likes Tomorrowland.
You are the Tomorrowland fan, exactly. And I appreciate that thematically speaking, this movie is a big swing, but in execution, it's not. It is it's swinging for singles. It's actually a fairly safe take on this kind of bold concept that it's laid out for itself. You're in fairly sure hands from a filmmaking standpoint. I just wish the jokes had landed harder when it's dealing up jokes, and I didn't necessarily feel that intense level of emotional investment when the movie takes a turn and gets very emotional. I do think it has some interesting things to say. There's a great line. It's actually in the trailer, so it's pretty fair game to quote, where Thomasin McKenzie, as Elsa, the girl who's in their attic, says to Jojo, "You're not a Nazi, Jojo. You're a 10-year-old kid who likes dressing up in a funny uniform and wants to be part of a club." That is an interesting story. This 10-year-old kid who sees the world through a very 10-year-old lens, he presents in this film as a Nazi. And then Taika Waititi spends the film kind of chipping away at that and interrogating that. And it's kind of about this kid's birth of skepticism. I do think that's interesting. I think the Sam Rockwell character arc is interesting. But it didn't really add up and cohere into a movie that I felt deeply invested in. And I didn't laugh hard enough at it when it was funny.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the Sam Rockwell character because, you know, there was a lot of talk about, is it okay to have a Hitler character who's funny? And I actually wasn't too troubled by that. I think it is, for one thing, it's such a trope. There have been
right.
so
it's
many.
Been
it's
done,
a weird
yeah.
thing to say, but like there have been so many funny Hitlers.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anything about the film that kind of gave me pause, it's that Sam Rockwell character.
I agree.
Because Sam Rockwell is presented as an officer, a kind of a somewhat bumbling but ultimately good-hearted Nazi. And it's that's the one where I felt like, and what is Sam Rockwell doing? Doing kind of this over and over? I think that's another interesting question for me. It's sort of in Three Billboards. He's the kind of ultimately decent-hearted. It's a strange thing to me. And I think I don't disagree that it's an interesting idea, but it gave me a little bit of pause because, and let me kind of link this to the story of Jojo that you were talking about. I think when they talk about kind of Jojo is not a real Nazi, that makes sense to me because Jojo is a child. But there is a view of hate and Nazis and other kinds of bigotry that holds that people don't really believe it. They're just sort of going along or they're decent at heart or something like that. And I think sometimes this film is not reckoning with the fact that very often, these things are deeply entrenched because people really believe them.
What we're coming up against here is the limitation of the film. One of the film's main limitations is that it's asking you to take nothing seriously. There are no stakes for the first two-thirds, and then all of a sudden there are. And the Sam Rockwell character fits into that because, you know, you're not looking for nuance from him, and then you get something approaching nuance, but it doesn't feel like emotional nuance. It feels like script nuance or joke nuance. It doesn't feel real.
Right. And the fact that they have set up Rebel Wilson as his sidekick is sort of adds to the sense that it's broad and slapsticky because she's doing very much her what I think of as her kind of thing here. She's being very silly and broad also.
That performance did nothing for me. That character did nothing for me. I want to have a conversation about the ending of this movie and Sam Rockwell's role in it, because I think there's more nuance there than you're giving it credit for.
Without sort of undermining the fact that Taika Waititi is so charming and so talented and clearly an icon, and a lot of people in Toronto went, I think, because anything that he does, they're there for him.
He has
his super fans. I thought that the film bit off more than it could chew, and also in terms of the Nazism and the portrait of radicalization that it was trying to look at, because I think while, yes, it could be a super fun, charming comedy, it was also trying in that second half to be a deep, searching film about how do you get pulled back from the brink of becoming a radical or a Nazi, and all the marketing is, you know, an anti-hate satire. It's sort of being marketed as a film for our time to help us think through how not to go the path that JoJo goes, and I just felt in that, too, Linda, you've mentioned that there have been a lot of like films that have made fun of Hitler and used funny Hitlers. There have also been quite a lot of films that look at this exact idea with a lot of nuance, too, is what happens when someone is sitting at that edge of going one way versus the other. And I didn't feel that this film had the, I don't know, for me at least, the sophistication and the depth to be able to really deal with that issue, which is really at the heart of it.
Yeah, I think all Waititi films feel personal. This guy can make a Marvel sprawling space opera and make it feel Waititian, I guess, is the term.
Made Thor Ragnarok, if you're not
Thor Ragnarok, yes. There is an anger bubbling here under the surface because, you know, the subject is Nazis scapegoating of an entire group and making up lies about them. And he's half Maori, half Jewish. And so this idea of the scapegoating of the other and the shocking ease with which that scapegoating kind of latches into a culture and then metastasizes within that culture. Again, I agree with you, Bilal. It's not taken up seriously here, but I think that's also coming from him.
I do think that he is a person who thinks idiosyncratically and independently. And I think sometimes the plus and the minus of people who kind of don't want to think very much about what other people's responses will be, there is a huge upside to that. And there can be a big downside to that. And I think I want to make sure that I address myself to, I think when a film has won the audience award and all these other things, I tend to sometimes skip over the things about it that I did really like and that I think are really powerful. Bilal was talking about the filmmaking. I think it's a beautiful looking movie. I thought about the fact that I, who am not a big Wes Anderson person, thought specifically about Moonrise Kingdom, and so did Bilal. Like, it feels that way. I think especially early because it has those almost like Boy Scouty views of Hitler Youth. But I think that it looks great. I actually think Scarlett Johansson is really interesting in this. I think what they're trying to get at with JoJo's mother is never fully explained, but in a way that I think is probably right. I already talked about how much I like Thomasin McKenzie, but we haven't really talked very much about Roman Griffin Davis, who is playing JoJo. Not only is he tremendously, I think, sympathetic and, you know, brings so much warmth to this story of this little kid who's a Hitler fan. He's also got really confident comic timing, as does Archie Yates, who's the kid who plays his best friend Yorkie. I could watch a JoJo and Yorkie like buddy movie for a very long time and be very happy. I think they're both hugely talented and they thread that needle for me where they are adorable, and yet I don't find them insufferable.
Or precocious.
I find them both enormously pleasant to watch. I was watching Archie Yates thinking, oh, when that kid's 30, he's going to be a huge comedy star. I mean, I think he's going to be a very funny character actor when he's an adult. So there is a lot about this movie that I really admired and that I really respect. There's a battle scene that I think makes very good use of slow motion and kind of interesting camera work to make that battle feel exactly the way they want you to perceive it. But there are just some things that just didn't hold together as well as I was hoping, I guess.
Taika Waititi has talked about this in interviews, that he finds American audiences, unlike audiences in New Zealand, divisive is seen as a bad thing here, and people tend to get quite sort of conservative about what they find offensive or uncomfortable, and that he was like, for me, I think if a movie divides people, that's a successful film. He said that in interviews. Do you feel that it's arriving into a time here for us as American audiences that is, like, are people responding to it in this mixed way, partly because of where we are?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I am. I think certainly I grew up kind of comfortably feeling like Nazi imagery was something that everyone agreed on that it was kind of a symbol of something we would never want to revisit. And I think I believe less firmly that that's the case. Yeah. And I don't mean to make light of that at all, but I do think that seeing that imagery is probably different for me than it used to be.
In the Mel Brooks film, the producers, when the big Broadway production number of Springtime for Hitler happens, half the audience walks out outraged. And I remember thinking that would never happen today. And you know, somebody says, talk about bad taste. And that is a conversation we're having again. This idea of the scapegoating of the other and plastering an entire group of people with a epithet or with characteristics because you feel you need to distance yourself from them. I think that's newly relevant.
And I did appreciate the depth with which it went into exactly what the othering of Jews in Germany looked like.
Right.
That it wasn't general. It was specific. Mm-hmm. There were specific accusations that were taught to children and things like that. And I think that I did appreciate that specificity, I think. Well, this one's a thinker, like I said. I really do admire it, and I admire the filmmaking, and I will be hugely curious to see what you guys think. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what is making us happy this week, so come right back.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of NPR's How I Built This, and on our latest episode, the story of how two public radio guys figured they could turn podcasts into profit and how they grew that hunch into Gimlet, a media company that sold for more than $200 million. Listen right now.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week. And let's face it, every week, what's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
All right, so at this point, I have tweeted repeatedly about Robert Eggers' new film, The Lighthouse. I have done a mini review on the NPR website. I have done a full review on the NPR website. I have harangued family, friends, and neighbors to go see this film. It opens wide this weekend as you listen to this. So I think at this point, the only thing I can still do is go door to door and frog march people into the theater and stand on street corners with a placard. Look, it's Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson as a lighthouse keeper and his assistant on a lonely island maintaining a lighthouse. That's it. That's the movie. It is so deeply committed to its wonderful, inveterate, egregious, and blithely weird weirdness that while I've admired a lot of films I've seen this year more, I have not spent every frame of them sitting in that seat, goggling, grinning ear to ear. Happens from the moment we first see the boat going to the lighthouse, parting the fog. Get your butt in a seat. Go see The Lighthouse this weekend.
Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, we're coming up on year-end coverage, but before we get to that, at NPR Music, we are doing end-of-the-decade coverage at All Songs Considered. We are doing a 10-episode series on All Songs Considered, looking back at the music and the trends of the 2010s, which we are doing right before getting into the usual end-of-the-year stuff. Already, several really interesting discussions have posted, including one that I got to be a part of, about social media and the birth of stan culture. But it's the decade in classical music. Five ways Beyoncé defined the decade in music. We've got segments coming up about the globalization of music, about jazz, about Latinx music in the wake of Despacito. There are a bunch of just really interesting discussions with a bunch of really interesting thinkers. I've been a part of several of those episodes. I'm really, really happy with how the series is taking shape. Go over to All Songs Considered if you don't already and check out these terrific discussions about the decade in music.
Oh, thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Bilal Qureshi, what's making you happy this week?
Well, what's making me happy connects a little bit to Stephen's decade, which is something related to Kanye West, who I know is someone that is really divisive as well, like the film we spoke about earlier, if not maybe more on the negative side these days. But what's making me happy is that he is releasing his new album as an IMAX concert film this weekend, and I'll go to the IMAX theater to watch mostly anything, even if it's the strangest, you know, nature documentary or something that's being, like, optimized for it. And so what's interesting to me about this is that I'm curious what he has done with turning this new gospel project that he's been working on into a concert film filmed in James Turrell, the artist's famous crater in Arizona that nobody's really ever seen before.
Oh,
and
wow.
he's brought these gospel choirs into the crater, and it's been filmed by this famous fashion photographer, and it's on for 3 days going to be playing at the Air and Space IMAX Theater down on the mall, which is just kind of one of those weirdly Kanye West-y things, but I'm actually, you know, interested in the fact that he still forces us to, I don't know, I mean, he forces us to think, and whether you like him or not, I think he does interesting, provocative things, and he reminds me of my growing up in the 2010s when Kanye West made a lot of music.
We had a long debate about whether to do the decade in Beyonce or the decade in Kanye.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, concert film, IMAX movie called Jesus is King.
Very nice. Spectacle.
Yeah,
I exactly. like it. I like an event. All right. Thank you, Bilal. What is making me happy this week? It is so easy to find the moments when social media is a curse upon the land and a nightmare for us all that I like to highlight the moments when it is actually a lot of fun. And I was watching The Great British Baking Show this weekend, a season I had already watched, as you do. And I happened to be thinking about cookies, and I made a comment on Twitter that no cookie I've ever seen is as good as the rolled up, the leftover rolled up pie crust cookies that my mom used to make. When you make a pie, you got some leftover, so you put butter and sugar and cinnamon on it, and then you roll it up, you cut it in slices, and you get little pinwheel cookies. And those were a big treat in my house whenever my mom made pies, which was mostly just holidays. And so I mentioned this on Twitter, and people began to tell me all about the pie crust cookie traditions in their houses growing up, including one person who said that they now have a sister-in-law who makes an entire log of those cookies for every person in the family now because they all love them so much. People who have different names for them, we call them pinwheels. People call them roly-polies, or they call them snails. Oh. And everybody's talking about what they call them. I was struck by the fact that the people who were sharing these traditions with me were overwhelmingly white people. And I was curious. I am curious and remain curious. And this is my call out. Perhaps if you have a family that isn't white people, I'm curious about what happened to the leftover pie crust or other kind of leftover dough for sweets happened in your family. Was it this? Was it something else? But it is, I love getting people to just talk about like mundane family traditions. And it was a lot of fun. We'll link to that tweet. Read about pie crust cookies. It really made me happy. It was a very sweet and lovely, lovely conversation. And it made me very happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find Bilal at B-Q-I-L-A-L. You can find our producer, Emmanuel Johnson, at Emmanuel_speaks. You can find our other producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second and you're so inclined, do subscribe to our newsletter. That's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That's how you find out what was making us happy this week and many other bits of news. We will see you right back here next week.